As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and we are recording at the later time of Thursday night so that we can bring you reaction to the biggest game of the season so far in the Premier League, the champions versus the league leaders. Alongside me in the studio, we welcome Alan Smith. Plus down the line, we're joined by Alison Rudd and from the Etihad, it is Henry Winter. Later on, we'll talk about the lack of silver lining at Everton. Plus, we discuss what's been a busy January for Chelsea. We begin, of course, with another significant swing in the title race. Liverpool would have gone 10 points clear of Manchester City with a victory at the Etihad, but the champions inflicted the first league defeat of the season on Jurgen Klopp's men to reduce the gap at the top of the table to 4 points. Leroy Sané scoring the winner with 18 minutes to play. Henry, we're so used to seeing City dominate games with their wonderful football, but Vincent Kompany said this performance came from the gut.
Well, it did. And I think it was totally embodied by Bernardo Silva, who ran, my maths is terrible, but he ran about 8.5 miles, which is a phenomenal achievement. And your point about the fact that City usually play with the land, and we associate that with Bernardo Silva, but he was almost like a sort of a Cruyff-style dog of war. The way he was hunting the ball, the way he was knocking players over, he was just, you know, as Vincent said, you know, it was a performance that that came from deep within, from within the gut, from their desire not to give up their title easily. So, formidable performance. And in a way, it shows what a complete team Manchester City are, because we know they can play teams off the park, but they can also go toe-to-toe with them.
They look far from defensively solid City, but it was the character of the likes of Kompany and Fernandinho that saw them through.
Yeah, I mean, Kompany was probably fortunate to stay on the pitch. I mean, if you leave the ground and you dive into a tackle like he did on Salah, I could understand why Jurgen Klopp was annoyed afterwards, and that would obviously have turned the game around quite dramatically. But yeah, look, Kompany was a formidable leader at the back, and look, with all their problems at left back and Benjamin Mendy being injured, they played Laporte there. And Laporte and John Stones, when they've been together at centre half, only in the first half of the season, it would have been a fantastic combination. So he had to break that up, but he brought Kompany in there alongside Stones, and Laporte went to left back, and he did pretty well. He didn't sort of venture too far forward. He just sort of stayed and sort of, you know, held the position and made sure Salah, whoever was from India, whoever's coming wide, would get past him. So, they were pretty resolute at the back, City.
Alison, it could have been very different. Liverpool were 11 millimetres away from opening the scoring. John Stones and Ederson colliding as the ball cannoned off Stones, who got back to clear. A goal line technology ruling, it hadn't crossed the line. It was a game of fine margins. Do you think Jurgen Klopp, though, will take some encouragement from this game, more than we might think?
Yeah, I thought he was reasonably upbeat afterwards in his post-match chat. You would say he would say that, wouldn't he? But I think there was a lot as they deconstruct the game. I think he'll find a lot that he liked about it. There were a lot of fine margins, and I sort of would like to see a parallel universe in which those millimetres went for Liverpool and there had been a red card for Vincent Kompany. And I really do think it was more of a red than a yellow. Really do think it was his tackle on Mo Salah. That's another fine margin. The goals scored by City were sort of very fine-tuned goals as well, and you could call them fine margins as well. So I think if you add them all up, and I think he'll do that, I think he'll say, look, we weren't completely outclassed. This was slightly unlucky, and there's a lot we can take from it. However, the other side of it is I've not seen a City side play like that before, and I've not heard Vincent Kompany come out with the superlatives post-match before. He said it was the most intense, best game he'd been part of, and this is a man who's won a lot and been through the emotional mill, and he was completely buzzing. They were a team who knew they were up against the best, and they haven't had to do that for a while. It's a huge compliment to Jurgen Klopp's side. I think probably that's the thing he'll take away most from it, that City showed them huge respect and put in an absolutely phenomenal effort to beat them.
One of the big talking points from the game, one that you've already mentioned, Alison, was whether or not Kompany should have stayed on the pitch. Alan, where do you stand on that?
I think it should have been a red. The way he lunged in and the sort of scissors motion makes that a red card. I don't see why it should only be a yellow. It's clearly dangerous, could have seriously injured Salah, and he's very, very lucky to stay on the pitch.
Well, as it is, Kompany did stay on the pitch. But let's talk about the first goal that broke the deadlock. 5 minutes before half-time, Sergio Aguero scoring in this fixture for the seventh league game in a row at the Etihad. Is there any blame, Alan, that we can attach to Lovren or Alisson for it?
Alisson, I don't think so. When I saw it the first time, I thought, he's been beaten at the near post. That's poor goalkeeping. But you just see the power with which Aguero struck the ball. You know, the reaction time is so minimal, and the force required with his hand to keep that strike out. So I wouldn't blame Alisson. I think Lovren was just incredibly poor all night, really. Both goals, you could arguably say he was at fault for them. The biggest error of all was when Sterling hit the post, or maybe the stanchion late in the second half, where he just really cheaply gave the ball away. Of course, people will point to sort of his comments saying, you know, he should be considered among the best defenders in the world, his predictions that Liverpool could go this season unbeaten. And even if you go back to the World Cup, when he was sort of boasting about Croatia being able to win the World Cup. And every time he makes one of these statements, it just seems to backfire spectacularly on him. He has been really good throughout this season before tonight, but it was just such a bad performance. Mm.
But Liverpool did respond in the second half, Alison. Roberto Firmino with his fourth goal in two games. Some sensational work from both Liverpool fullbacks in the build-up to it.
Yeah, no, it was a very attractive goal. And as we've seen with City this season, when they have come and stuck it, those cross-field floated passes that sort of take out all their diggy men that have proved so effective. And I did wonder why Liverpool didn't try more of that. They're capable of it, pinging it, you know, from wing to wing, being clever. And it was really lovely, and so lovely, in fact, that if you sort of watch it again, the City defenders are almost sort of awestruck, like how, you know, you see a little bubble coming out of their head saying, how are we supposed to defend against that? It was inch-perfect passing, fullback to fullback, as you say, and Andy Robertson just seems to have made it, you know, a thing of his own this season, this ability to make the right run and then know how to create an opening for a forward. He's very unselfish and very intuitive, you know, probably a player that Guardiola would love in his team. Really, really beautiful goal. But having said that, I never really felt Liverpool were going to kick on having scored it. It just seemed to really annoy City, and then they sort of seemed to have that passion, that initiative. That's certainly something I've just not seen from them. The thing is, I think it was an inverted day, if you like, inverted evening, because City had all that sort of passion that the underdogs get, and Liverpool were trying to be regal and composed and not get too excitable by the whole occasion. In fact, when they do let rip and let passion take over, sometimes they are unstoppable. They were just a tad restrained, I felt, Liverpool.
And Raheem Sterling, well, he took centre stage, driving at the Liverpool back line and setting up Sane for the winner. A big night for him, Henry, particularly in the absence of Kevin De Bruyne.
Well, I thought he was terrific. I mean, you know, De Bruyne was on the bench. He could have been brought on. Guardiola brought on Gundogan in the end, which I thought was quite interesting. But look, De Bruyne is a fabulous player. But look, Sterling was terrific, but he was up against one of the best left-backs in Europe in Andy Robertson, and they had a real tussle. And Sterling maybe probably did his best work when he started cutting inside, certainly for creating Sane's goal.
Kyle Walker, who was left out by Pep Guardiola for the third game in a row. He hasn't played since City's defeat at home to Palace just before Christmas. And Paul Hurst reports that Pep still hasn't forgiven Walker for his performance in that game, blaming him for the two goals. Henry, what are the potential England implications, do you think?
Well, I think that the implications are mainly for Manchester City at the moment, and that is Kyle Walker being a good professional, will show in training how determined he is to get back in that position that he's better than Danilo. In terms of England, I mean, England is certainly not short of right backs at the moment. So, that's a problem for February and March, and I don't think it's a particularly huge problem. And I'm sure Kyle Walker will be back playing regularly for Manchester City. Then, I mean, Guardiola may be annoyed at one or two things that have happened, but he also knows the quality of Kyle Walker, who's a good pro, and I'm sure he'll give him another chance.
And in terms of the title race, Henry, Liverpool have been to the Etihad, Wembley, Stamford Bridge and the Emirates already. They've played City twice. They still find themselves in a great position. They are 4 points clear after all.
Well, they are. And I think what was interesting listening to Jurgen Klopp's interviews afterwards, I mean, he was polite. He paid due respect to Manchester City. He had his little moan about Vincent Kompany. But you could tell underneath that he was just absolutely determined to get back to Melwood, to get the players in tomorrow morning or the morning after, probably have a much changed team in the Cup, and just to work on going on another unbeaten run, because Klopp is a winner and that he will just drive them on again. Maybe he could have been a little bit more adventurous with his central midfield choices. Maybe he could have made the Shaqiri substitution slightly earlier. But look, he's a winner as a manager, just like Guardiola is. Just like you couldn't write off Guardiola yesterday, you can't write off Klopp tomorrow.
I think in terms of momentum, it could be quite big. People are quite keen to point out that, you know, Spurs aren't out of it yet. But if you look at sort of the remaining fixtures, Spurs obviously have to go to Anfield and to the Etihad, whereas Liverpool and City have both played the big teams away. I think they both need to go to Old Trafford, but apart from that, the rest of their games against the top six are at home, which I think is crucial. In terms of City and Liverpool, sort of head-to-head, you can't sort of underrepresent the fact that City have been here before, have this experience, whereas Liverpool, you know, we could, it's easy to go back to sort of the Gerrard slip and things like that, but, you know, psychologically, those issues could still linger, despite, you know, a different manager, despite the players being vastly different to past seasons. But I just feel like City, having seen them perform in this manner, they looked kind of, you know, far more hungry. The fight was back, and like Alison mentioned a couple of minutes ago, they sort of, you know, this was a different approach. They looked different to what they've looked like in the past few seasons, and I think it's quite easy to imagine them going on a really, really good run of, you know, 7-8 victories in a row. And unless Liverpool, you know, Liverpool need to get back and get back into that groove again, because if not, that gap could just be completely closed very, very quickly.
Yeah, Alice, where do you stand on all of this? I mean, the psychological side of it is going to be an issue for Liverpool. They haven't been in this position for a long time, in the sense of being so close to running away with the league. Are there any concerns about Liverpool heading into the end of this season?
Well, I mean, there are the obvious concerns that you do worry about injury. There's no point worrying about them. You can't do much about it. I would be concerned if some of their key players got injured. I just don't feel there is going to be much of a psychological impact from this. It's not as if Liverpool were completely outplayed at the Etihad. I think it was a huge compliment to them the way that City lifted their game. And I think if you go through the rest of the season, how many times are City going to be able to reproduce what they did against Liverpool in games which proved tough? I just don't think any team can have that amount of oomph in them. And Liverpool, I think, aren't going to come up against a team capable of doing what City did at the Etihad. So I think they've had the most challenging evening of the season. And yes, they didn't get anything from it. But I don't think it would damage them psychologically to know that City gave, in Vincent Kompany's words, the best performance in his playing career in order to do that to them. If you're clever about it, you just make that something which makes you feel even more imperious and more capable of winning the title.
I think it also could help that, you know, it's early January. If tonight had happened in, say, late March and there were six games to go, and then I think momentum at that point can have a far bigger effect in terms of City closing the gap and overtaking them. But I think there are so many games still left that Liverpool could still have a little blip, pull themselves together, and it would be fine. It being early January helps Liverpool quite a bit.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Every Thursday at thetimes.co.uk, our very own Bill Edgar provides 11 trivia teasers for you, and here is one for you on this podcast. Aside from 2013-14, when Manchester City won the title and both teams scored 100 goals, Liverpool and City have only once finished as the top two in the table. That was in 1976-77. Which member of Pep Guardiola's current backroom staff was City's leading goal scorer that season? Stick around to the end of the podcast to find out the answer. Now, across Merseyside, it's not so rosy for Everton right now. Just one win in the last eight for the Toffees, a miserable Christmas period compounded by defeat at home to Leicester on New Year's Day. Paul Joyce wrote for The Times on Wednesday and spoke of Marco Silva as being under pressure. Alison, would you agree with that?
Well, I don't think he's in imminent danger of being sacked. I don't think there's any appetite for that at the board of Everton. They've made mistakes with management, and they were really hoping to get some sort of period of stability. The most interesting thing I thought in Paul Joyce's piece was he said, "We just don't know what sort of manager Silva is," and I think that's right. I think it, if we're talking about Everton being a team that are trying really hard to break into the top six with the amount of money they've spent, their history and their need to make a mark on the Premier League at some point, most of the managers that are successful in the upper echelons, you know what they stand for, you know what they like, you know the sort of players they go for, you know what systems they prefer. And those managers also have a track record, and you can point to where they've done well and done badly, what they've learned along the way. Marco Silva is still a bit of a mystery. Mm-hmm. And so I think he has to prove, A, to the Everton fans that he knows what he's doing, to the people who pay his wages that he knows what he's doing. And the players, too, I'm not entirely sure they act when they're out on the pitch. I look at Everton, and I mean, I can categorise them. They are still a group of individuals that have been assembled somewhat messily over the past couple of seasons. And Marco Silva, he meddles with the formation a bit. He moves things around. I don't feel I know exactly that he has confidence in the players he has, and I think don't think he believes he's going to be given much more money to meddle and tinker with what he's got. So it's all a bit of a mishmash, and mishmashes don't get you into the top six.
Well, you mentioned Paul has written about people not knowing exactly who Silva is. Well, he's been in England for 2 years. He's taken 74 points from 63 games, doesn't tend to stay anywhere too long. So, Alan, can you understand that there are perhaps doubts about his long-term credentials as a manager?
I think what's going to be different this time is that obviously when he left Watford, it was because he'd been courted by Everton, whereas now, because of Everton's recent run of form, you know, he's not going to have another club courting him to tempt him away. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops when it comes to that. But I was looking at this earlier, and I think he'd managed Hull for 20 to 22 games, a similar amount at Watford, and he's at that point with Everton now. And I think at all three clubs he's had something like 8 league wins, just nice piece of symmetry. But he just doesn't know. I don't think he knows his best team at the minute. He's got a lot, you know, it's a really good squad. You can look at the bench and you think, you know, there are quite a few talented players here, but what's the best system that suits them? And, you know, if he chooses a system, who are the best players to fit that? In terms of their record this season, I think they've really, you know, if their long-term aim is to break into the top six, it's quite notable that they've taken a point against Chelsea, and apart from that, they've lost every other game against the top six. Another big issue is goals. Richarlison and Sigurdsson have scored 9 and 8 goals respectively, but apart from that, they just don't really have anybody capable of contributing regularly.
Well, as written in the Times this week, only Liverpool, Chelsea and the Manchester clubs have spent more over the last three transfer windows than Everton. So seventh, Alison, that has to be the minimum requirement, doesn't it, for them this season?
Well, I do think they'll be lucky to get that, to be quite honest, because the other problem is I don't see progression. They are up and down, up and down. They look as capable of losing badly as winning quite well. I mean, that's just not how you get to minimum requirement of seventh. I agree with you. You know, given their spend, that's what they should be looking at. But they don't. They're not gelling. They're not gelling. And I think you could. I don't know. It sounds harsh, but I'm not even sure that those players are getting better through the season. I've seen Jordan Pickford make more mistakes than I thought he was capable of making. Keane, I was never entirely sure he was, you know, a top-rated defender. Everyone was sort of, you know, oh my word, everyone's after him. Well, I don't think he's progressed enormously at Everton. There were doubts about Mina at Barcelona. I think it's going to take him quite a long time to reach his full potential. Coleman's getting on a bit. I could go through the team. But, Walcott, for example, I sometimes feel Everton are playing with 10 men because he does so little. He has pace, but he does very little. A ball to him is often a dead end ball. I don't know why Marco Silva perseveres with him. I just don't see progress through that team. They ought to be gelling more with each passing week. They ought to be finding a system that suits them. And it just looks meddlesome. And there's an element of doubt in the air when they play. And if I cared a lot about Everton, I'd be worried about that.
Well, they do have a break from the Premier League this weekend. They host Lincoln City, the leaders of League Two, in the FA Cup third round on Saturday. And of course, Danny Cowley's Imps were quarter finalists just 2 years ago. So the pressure could really mount if we see a shock at Goodison. By contrast, it was a very merry Christmas for Leicester with 3 wins out of 4, including victories over Chelsea and Manchester City. Leicester are currently in seventh, which last season was good enough for a Europa League place. So, Alan, do you fancy their chances of a seventh place finish?
I think it's quite possible. I know we discussed this briefly last week, where you're never quite sure what team to expect when Leicester turn up, because they can be really, really good, and they can also be quite awful. Some players don't seem to like Puel's system, but then at the same time, he sort of dug in when he was under pressure a couple of weeks back, and they've produced this really, really impressive Christmas. The case now is if they can kick on. I know they've got a really, really difficult run of games towards the end of this month, where they think they play Liverpool, Man United and Spurs. Then they've got a really easy run of games, and the final three games are Arsenal, City and Chelsea. So if it's tight going into those final three matches of the season, I would fancy the other teams who are in the run-up against them. And I think, looking at the table at the minute, despite their own inconsistencies, I would have a small guess that it could be Wolves who would finish seventh, because their run of form against the big teams has been excellent. They've taken points off of all of the big six apart from Liverpool, who they still have to play again later in the campaign, which is, you know, obviously in wild contrast to what we'd said about Everton earlier on. Their issue is producing against the lesser sides, which kind of, you know, suggests that they're more than capable of finishing in seventh position if they can kind of get their act together against those teams near the bottom.
You're comparing Everton and Leicester, aren't you? Mm. And you're wondering who might grab seventh. But what I think is interesting, if you compare Everton and Leicester, is Leicester players have moaned about their manager, and the fans have moaned about their manager, and there's a sense that the system doesn't work. Nobody has come out in the ranks at Everton and complained about Marco Silva, and yet when you watch both teams play, it is Leicester who, when they are actually playing the games, are playing with freedom of expression, freedom of movement. They look like they're having fun. They look like they know what the system is, even if it's sometimes not one that plays to all the players' advantages. I mean, that it's very peculiar that the team that's supposed to be split in the camp is the one that plays with some joy, and the team that's supposed to be uniting behind a young, promising manager is the one that looks disjointed.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Another side in need of some home comforts is Chelsea, who have failed to score in the last two matches at Stamford Bridge. Maurizio Sarri hinted he wanted a striker in January after the goalless draw with Southampton on Wednesday. This is what he actually said. We have to try to solve the problem of the last 15, 20 metres. The club knows very well my opinion. I think we need something different for characteristics. I'm not in charge of the market, but I have to try to improve my players, my team, my offensive phase, or better my offensive phase in the last 20 metres. Now, Alvaro Morata has failed to score in seven consecutive Premier League games. Alan, it must be pretty hard for Morata to not take those comments from Sarri personally.
Yeah, I think that last goal was in maybe early November, and since then we've sort of seen Eden Hazard sort of playing up front, a role that he doesn't particularly seem to like either, although he has, you know, because Morata has been quite poor, Hazard has seemed more effective, even though he doesn't really want to be there. In terms of Sarri asking for more options up front, you know, the Christian Pulisic signing this week will be, you know, the next season will be quite interesting to see how that works out, because I think he's obviously a player who's not exactly kicked on at Dortmund this season, struggled to get into the team, but he will offer something different. In the middle of that quote from Sarri, the most interesting thing is the fact he says he's not interested in the market, or not in charge of the market, rather, where he wasn't aware that Pulisic signing was going to go through until something like 24 hours beforehand. But he's gone to the club and he said, this is what I feel we need. Morata's long-term future, I don't think he really has one at Chelsea, because he's had... started quite well beginning of last season, but then really faded. I remember he scored a hat-trick away to Stoke and he looked like, you know, Diego Costa had gone, and it was sort of, you know, this guy is kind of not such a like-for-like replacement because he's very different players, but, you know, as effective, he's going to score a similar number of goals and that's it. And then his form just completely fell off a cliff, and this season he just hasn't been able to click whatsoever.
You mentioned that signing of Pulisic. He, of course, signing from Borussia Dortmund, being loaned back to the German club as well until the end of the season. Alison, many have talked about the young players like Callum Hudson-Odoi, like Ruben Loftus-Cheek, and once again they may be pushed down the pecking order.
Yeah, I know it's a strange one. We almost seem to be reaching the point where young British players are valued more abroad than they are here, and here we value overseas players more than we do the players you know well. It does seem very peculiar. It does seem really peculiar, the disconnect at Chelsea, that they can't quite. I mean, Sarri has said all along it's not. He would really like to bring through young British players that Chelsea own, but he finds that they're tactically not as astute as players brought up in overseas systems. And that's his reasoning for keeping them on the fringes largely. The problem with that is that Sarri ball is so specific and so technical and tactical that you can't afford to experiment much. He knows what he knows is why he's so committed to Jorginho, because that's a player who knows inside out what his system is and what's required of him. And you can't sort of learn on the job. You'll lose too many points and lose your job. So he's actually, although he said he doesn't know what's happening in the market, it's not his business to know. He's so conservative. I wouldn't think he'd be looking to to do anything other than replicate what he's already got there, and rather than trying to spend too long teaching what he's got. But there is a lot that the younger players can give to a Chelsea team. They ignite the crowd, which is often quite placid at Stamford Bridge, and they really, really love it when one of their own players comes on the pitch. It really lifts them. They have energy, passion. I think every club needs a connection with a player on the pitch. So, you know, the days of John Terry and Frank Lampard have gone. They need players they can identify with, and I think it's slightly short-sighted to be so technically oriented that you overlook those elements to pacey, physical, keen young players who've come through the Chelsea system and want to make it work there. And I just think it's a bit ironic they're signing an American via Dortmund when they've got at least 50 decent players come through their own academy.
Would I have been really cynical? I do think the fact that Pulisic is American, and I believe Chelsea are sort of investing in the American market in terms of expanding their sort of reach there, has an effect as well. We look at the transfer fee and we kind of think, you know, this is massive money, but at the same time, in terms of sort of exposure in the US, and, you know, clubs pretty much go there every summer for the preseason tour now, so, you know, they're going to recoup a lot of that money, you'd imagine, very quickly, because if they become sort of the Premier League's, you know, big team in the US.
Yeah, almost £60 million they will have spent on Pulisic. As I was saying, he won't be coming to the club until the summer. But Chelsea are the FA Cup holders. They host Nottingham Forest on Saturday, a game that many believe will be Cesc Fabregas's last for Chelsea. He's believed to be joining his former Arsenal teammate Thierry Henry at Monaco. So, Alison, if I start with you, a word from you on his career in English football.
Yeah, you know, he's graced it. His passing ability is just lovely to behold. I think the trademark memories I will have of him are those dinked, very beautifully weighted balls into the path of a striker, and how the strikers always sort of known they're coming. He has been able to build relationships through his time at Arsenal and Chelsea with players around him. He's completely unselfish. And I do like players like that. You genuinely feel that he enjoys the creation of a goal rather than the scoring of it. I'm sort of slightly disappointed that doesn't seem to be room anymore for a Pirlo-type figure to operate. You know, he's lost his... he didn't have that much athleticism, I suppose. But, I mean, it's almost like he's being put out to pasture because he has so little time on the pitch now. I don't blame him for leaving. But you sort of think there must be a way for someone who creates time, creates space, because they read the game so well, to have just slightly longer in the Premier League. But yeah, no, he's been a great addition to football in this country. He'll be missed.
Alan?
I was thinking earlier where I would rank him among sort of Premier League imports, and I think among Spanish players I'd probably put him second behind David Silva. The one thing with Fabregas that always kind of stands out for me is that because he arrived in England at quite a young age first, I always seem to think that he's a lot older than 31. I mean, he was never really the quickest player in terms of overall pace. And because of Jorginho at Chelsea, and, you know, Sarri's plan just centres around him, opportunities have obviously been incredibly limited. So, you know, you can't blame him for wanting to move on. And at 31, he obviously feels that he's got a number of seasons still to play.
OK, just time to give you the answer to Bill Edgar's trivia teaser. Aside from the 2013-14 season, when Manchester City won the title and both teams scored 100 goals, Liverpool and City have only once finished as the top two in the table. That was in 1976-77. The question is, which member of Pep Guardiola's current backroom staff was City's leading goal scorer that season? The answer... Brian Kidd, and he might just be involved in City and Liverpool finishing in the top two again this season. That's a cracker from Bill. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Alison Rudd, Alan Smith and Henry Winter. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we'll be back on Monday, as will Gab Marcotti, to look back at the FA Cup and ahead to the Carabao Cup semi-finals.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.